Welcome to Science, Ethics, and the Future, the podcast of the Foundational Research Institute, foundational-research.org. I'm Brian Tomasik. Today I'll be reading the text of an essay called Do Video Game Characters Matter Morally? By me, Brian Tomasik. It was written in March 2014. In April 2014, Dylan Matthews, at the website Vox, contacted me with regard to this essay and asked to interview me about it. The resulting Vox article was widely shared, including 171 links from Twitter and 1,337 from Facebook. The text of this essay is a more complete and nuanced account of my views than what's in the interview. While I don't think video game characters per se are highly important relative to other issues, they provide a fun and insightful platform in which to probe our intuitions about sentience more generally. Now here's the piece, Do Video Game Characters Matter Morally? Summary. The difference between non-player characters, NPCs, in video games, and animals in real life is a matter of degree rather than kind. NPCs and animals are both fundamentally agents that emerge from a complicated collection of simple physical operations, and the main distinction between NPCs and animals is one of cognitive and affective complexity. Thus, if we care a lot about animals, we may care a tiny bit about game NPCs, at least the more elaborate versions. I think even present-day NPCs collectively have some ethical significance, though they don't rank near the top of the ethical issues in our current world. However, as the sophistication and number of NPCs grow, our ethical obligations toward video game characters may become an urgent moral topic. As a point of clarification, according to Wikipedia's article on NPCs, nearly always the connotation is that an NPC is allied with, or at least neutral toward, the player, while hostile characters are referred to as enemies, mobs, or creeps. In this piece, my discussion focuses on enemy characters, because in many games, enemies are by far the most numerous. In addition, gamers generally inflict more damage to enemies than neutral NPCs, so enemy characters present the most important moral questions. I'm not sure if there is a better term that I should be using. I felt that enemies or mobs or monsters was too specific, e.g. because it rules out non-enemy NPCs, which may also be morally relevant. Introduction. Video games raise a number of ethical issues for society. Probably the most fiercely debated is whether gory video games affect proclivities for real-world violence. Some studies find no causal relationship between video games and violence, while other studies, including experimental manipulations, do suggest some causal pathway toward real-world aggression. See Wikipedia's article for more. My subjective experience jives with the desensitization hypothesis, though some will probably argue in the reverse direction that video games allow for releasing aggression in a harmless way. Another ethical issue sometimes raised is the addictive potential of video games, which can decrease school or job performance, impair relationships, and so on. Some also fear that video games are more mind-numbing than books and will inhibit the intellectual growth of youth. Others point out that video games are a form of art that can be quite complex and challenging, and MMORPGs like World of Warcraft may even teach players planning, teamwork, and leadership. These topics are worth exploring, but they're not my focus here. In this piece, I ask a less common question. Do the characters in video games matter ethically, not just for instrumental reasons, but for their own sakes? I don't know if I've ever heard this question asked before, at least not with respect to present-day video games. Most people would brush it off as ridiculous. But I think the answer is not so obvious on further examination. Fiction versus reality. Children learn to separate fiction from reality around the ages of 3 to 5 years old. Context helps determine the distinction. As an example, in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, the show's real characters lived in the outside world, while the fictional characters lived in an explicitly separate neighborhood of make-believe. Children learn that their families, friends, national leaders, and science facts are part of reality, while fiction books, movies, and video games are fictional. It's okay if fiction characters get hurt, because they don't actually exist. When a child sees a character in a movie fall injured, a parent can console the child by explaining that the people on screen are just actors and the blood is not real. Likewise, it seems obvious that the violence in video games is not real, and hence doesn't matter unless it leads to antisocial behavior in the actual world. But what is reality, anyway? Our real world of cars and families and love and future plans is a complex arrangement of tiny physical particles into higher and higher levels of abstraction. Atoms to molecules to proteins to cells to organs to people, which interact in societies. We are extremely elaborate machines built from masses of dumb, elementary physical operations that are put together in ways that form something beautifully dynamic and meaningful. Reality consists of all the higher-level abstractions that we use to make sense of these complicated particle movements. These abstractions are what matter to us and determine whether we're happy or depressed, hopeful or afraid. Some neuroscience research by Anna Abraham and D. Eve von Kremen suggests that our sense of what's real is determined by its relevance and degree of personal connection to us. Now, consider an elaborate, intelligent video game character. It, too, is built in layers of abstraction, from tiny physical stuff, electrons and atoms, to transistors, to logic gates, to computer hardware, run using machine code, which is compiled from human-readable code, which itself is organized in a modular fashion, from individual statements, to functions, to classes, to software packages, all within computers that can interact in computer networks. We could say the computer character isn't real because it's just a collection of dumb physical operations that are each extremely simple and unfeeling. But we too are built from dumb, unfeeling physical operations. The transistors that comprise the video game character's brain are just as real as the neurons that comprise yours. In both cases, we can even point to the clumps of matter that are involved. Okay, one might acknowledge, the character's brain is as real as mine, but its world is fake. I'm interacting with real physics, while this character is interacting with fantasy physics. But is there really such a big distinction? The trees, rocks, and walls in your world are clusters of fundamental particles behaving in sophisticated aggregate ways. For instance, the atoms in your chair are acting so as to hold themselves together. The video game character also interfaces with objects, atoms and electrons and transistors, for example, that are made of fundamental physical particles acting in particular ways that define their behavior. The behavior of those particles is different between the cases, but the kind of thing going on is similar. If it helps, we could imagine the dungeon walls in a Legend of Zelda game as being actual physical walls that the atoms defining the protagonist, Link, bumps up against when he tries to move into them. It's not the case that these walls in the CPU are spatially arranged in the same configuration as the walls in the game, but they're logically arranged in the configuration in the game, according to a complex mathematical mapping from atoms and electrons to virtual walls. What is the mapping? It's defined by the game's code. In a similar fashion, the building walls that we experience are themselves complicated mappings of the basic elements of reality. We don't experience decoherence as we split into the many worlds of quantum mechanics, nor do we experience the 7 extra dimensions of M-theory beyond 3 spatial and 1 temporal dimension. As Donald D. Hoffman notes in The Interface Theory of Perception, just as the icons of a PC's interface hide the complexity of the computer, so our perceptions usefully hide the complexity of the world and guide adaptive behavior. The game character's perceptions likewise interface appropriately with the logical boundaries of its world. Real entities are patterns that emerge from low-level physical particle interactions, and meaningful patterns can be seen in changes of currents and voltages inside microprocessors, as well as in configurations of biomolecules inside organisms. Goal-directed behavior and sentience. If video games can be seen as real in a similar way as our own world, what distinguishes video game characters from real people and animals? I think it comes down to differences in complexity, especially with regard to specific algorithms that we associate with sentience. As I've argued elsewhere, sentience is not a binary property, but can be seen with varying degrees of clarity in a variety of systems. We can interpret video game characters as having the barest rudiments of consciousness, such as when they reflect on their own state variables, self-awareness, report on state variables to make decisions in other parts of the program, information broadcasting, and select among possible actions to best achieve a goal, imagination, planning, and decision-making. Granted, these procedures are vastly simpler than what happens in animals, but a faint outline is there. If human sentience is a boulder, present-day video game characters might be a grain of sand. Digital agents using biologically plausible cognitive algorithms seem most likely to warrant ethical consideration. This is especially true if they use reinforcement learning, have a way of representing positive and negative valence for different experiences, and broadcast this information in a manner that unifies different parts of their brains into a conscious collective. Yet, I find it plausible that other attributes of an organism matter at least a little bit as well, such as engaging in apparently goal-directed behavior, having a metric for betterness versus worseness of its condition, and executing complex operations in response to environmental situations. Many NPCs in video games have some of these attributes, at least to a vanishing degree, even if most, thankfully, don't yet have frameworks for reinforcement learning or sophisticated emotion. Many NPCs exhibit goal-directed behavior, even if that just means implementing a pathfinding algorithm or choosing in which direction to face in order to confront the game's protagonist. Consider an example from a real video game, Doom 3, BFG Edition. In the file ai.c++, we can see implementations of how AIs can kick obstacles, face enemy, move to enemy height, move to attack position, etc. Of course, these functions are extremely simple compared with what happens if a real animal is engaged in an action. But the distinction is one of complexity, of one of degree rather than kind. Real animals' actions to kick obstacles, face enemies, etc. involve many more steps, body parts, and high-level systems. But at bottom, they're built from the same kinds of components as we see here. Especially in RPGs, some NPCs have explicit representations of their welfare level, in the form of hit points, HP, and the NPCs implement at least crude, rule-based actions aiming to preserve their HP. In some turn-based RPGs, like Super Mario RPG or Pokemon, an NPC may even choose an action whose sole purpose is to bolster its defenses against damage in subsequent rounds of the battle. The extent of damage may affect action selection. For example, in Revenge of the Titans, drones select a building to target based on a rating formula that incorporates HP damage. Even NPCs without explicit HP levels have an implicit degree of welfare, such as a binary flag for whether they've been killed. NPCs that require multiple strikes to be slain, for example, a boss who needs to be struck with a sword 3 times to die, carry HP state information not exposed to the user. They also display scripted aversive reactions in response to damage. Consciousness and power. A recurrent criticism of this piece is the observation that NPCs don't have sophisticated self-monitoring functionality of the type that would give them truly conscious experience rather than going through life in the dark. I acknowledge that this complaint is relevant, and maybe I would agree that upon reflection, NPCs don't matter very much because their self-reflection is often not well refined. But we should think about how robust our view is that self-monitoring specifically is the crucial feature of emotional experience. In the article, Feelings Integrate the Central Representation of Appraisal-Driven Response Organization in Emotion, Klaus R. Scherer suggests 5 different components of emotion. In the online version of this article, I reproduce his Table 9.1. I won't read the whole thing here, but I'll read the 5 different emotion functions that he describes. Evaluation of objects and events, system regulation, preparation and direction of action, communication of reaction and behavioral intention, monitoring of internal state, and organism-environment interaction. We can see that emotion is a complex process with many parts at play. Why would we then privilege just the subjective feeling component as the only one that we think matters? One reason might be that it's potentially the most central feature of the system. In Scherer's view, the monitoring process helps coordinate and organize the other systems. But then, privileging it seems akin to suggesting that among a team of employees, only the leader who manages the others and watches their work has significance, and the workers themselves are irrelevant. In any case, depending on how we define monitoring and coordination, These processes may happen at many levels, just like a corporate management pyramid has many layers. I think the reason people place such emphasis on the monitoring component is that it's the part of the system that the centers of their brains that perform abstract analysis and linguistic cognition can see. When we introspect using our self-monitoring apparatus, so naturally that's what we say matters to us. But why couldn't the subsystems matter if we knew from neuroscience that they were there, even if we couldn't identify them by introspection? Intuitively, we may not like this proposal, because we tend not to care about what we can't feel directly, out of sight, out of mind. But if we take a more abstracted view of the situation, it becomes less clear why monitoring is so essential. Why couldn't we also care about a collection of workers that didn't have a manager or a reporter? The focus on monitoring rather than the unconscious subcomponents seems to be an issue of power. The parts of us that think about moral issues are disposed to care about the monitoring functionality, in a similar way as the President of the United States gets all the attention by the media, even though it's his underlings who do most of the work. Once we see roughly how affective systems are operating in computational brain models, do we feel inclined to give more power to those voiceless subcomponents, or do we want to continue to favor the conscious monitoring part that our instincts incline us to care about? I don't have a settled opinion on this, but I think we shouldn't jump to the conclusion that only the monitor matters. This question can be particularly relevant in cases where the non-conscious components diverge from the conscious summary, or are not reported at all. And it's also relevant for agents like NPCs that may have only rudimentary monitoring going on relative to the amount of so-called unconscious computation. In any case, NPCs do have extremely crude monitors of their internal status, such as display of hit points or verbalized exclamations they make, e.g. screaming. And we can see how other components of emotion that I discussed above also show themselves in bare-bones ways within NPCs. Dennett's stance levels. NPCs differ in their degree of sophistication. For example, consider the game Squirrel Eat Squirrel in Chapter 8 of Al Swigart's Making Games with Python and Pygame. The program for this game is extremely simple, just 396 lines of code, not counting what's imported from Pygame. Squirrels of various sizes walk onto the screen from various directions. If they're smaller than the protagonist squirrel, the protagonist eats them, else they hurt the protagonist. They may occasionally change direction at random, but this is all they do. They don't plan routes, seek to avoid damage, or even try to face the protagonist. They just move randomly, and if they hit the protagonist, either they're eaten or they cause injury. The NPC squirrels in this game could be adequately described by what Daniel Dennett calls the physical stance, behaviors comparable to particles moving around or other crude physical processes. These are the dumb particle updates from which all higher-level cognitive stances appear as emergent phenomena. For instance, the squirrel game could be seen to resemble planets in space. If a big planet like Earth runs into a small asteroid, the asteroid is absorbed and makes Earth somewhat bigger. If Earth runs into a bigger planet than itself, it gets blasted apart and damaged. We could think of plenty of other physical analogies, like water droplets collecting together. In Super Mario Bros., Goombas and Koopa Troopas can be seen purely with the physical stance, because they just walk in one direction until they hit an obstacle, at which point they go the opposite way. A bouncing ball is comparable, indeed, arguably somewhat more complicated due to acceleration, friction, etc. Non-animal-like environmental features of games could be seen as comparably sophisticated, such as the dangerous water drips or falling rocks in crystal caves. Each level of crystal caves also features an air station, which explodes if the game's protagonist accidentally shoots it. The behavior of this air station is not much simpler than that of the most basic game enemies. After all, the air station dies if shot, although it doesn't move around or cause damage to the protagonist. But it can be modeled entirely within the physical stance. Other NPCs are a little more complex. For instance, the Hammer Brothers in Super Mario Bros. Turn to face Mario, and if Mario waits long enough, they begin to chase after Mario. This behavior could put them closer to the level of the intentional stance. They have beliefs about where Mario is located, and they have the goal of hammering him, so they move in order to position themselves to better achieve that goal. Many advanced game AIs are best described by the intentional stance, even if they don't use sophisticated academic AI algorithms. Of course, that something should be modeled by the intentional stance doesn't obviously imply that we should care about it ethically. Many computing operations outside the realm of video games also seem to require the intentional stance. Load balancers, query optimizers, and many other optimization processes are best modeled by considering what the system knows, what it wants to achieve, and predicting that it will act so as to best achieve that goal within the space of possibilities that it can consider. Search engines are probably best modeled by the intentional stance. Given beliefs about what the user is looking for, they strive toward the goal of providing the best results, or more pragmatically, results that will lead to satisfied-seeming user behavior. Outside the computing realm, we could see corporations as intentional agents, with beliefs about how to best achieve their goals of maximizing shareholder value. If we're at least somewhat moved by the intentional stance, we might decide to care a tiny bit about query optimizers and corporations, as well as video game AIs. I just want to make sure we realize what we're signing up for if we include intentional behavior on our list of ethically relevant characteristics. The fact that video game characters look more like animals than does a search engine might bias our sentiments. Or we might decide that superficial resemblance to animals is not totally morally irrelevant either. Does the intentional stance cover too much? Consider these examples. 1. A washer is tied to a string. If you hold the string, the washer will always orient to face down towards the earth. If you pull up the washer, it will fall back down if it can. You can put the washer on a table and thwart its effort to hit the floor. 2. An electron is circling around a positive charge. If you push the electron away, it tries to go back toward the positive charge. Thanks to a friend for inspiring this example. In the movie The House Bunny, a character says, "I want to be your girlfriend more than an electron wants to attach to a proton," which suggests that attributing a goal to the electron makes sense. The boundaries between the physical design and intentional stances aren't perfectly clear. Maybe the difference is one of intelligence on the part of the intentional agent. Washers trying to fall and electrons seeking protons aren't very smart at avoiding obstacles. But then again, neither are the Hammer Brothers. Still, ability to achieve one's goals isn't obviously crucial. Imagine that you have an overwhelming desire to discover the theory of everything that describes physics, but you can't even understand first grade math due to a learning disability. Or suppose that your loved one has died and you have an overwhelming desire to see her again, even though this isn't possible for you, due to not having reconstructive nanotech or whatever. Do your desires not matter very much in these cases because you're not smart enough to accomplish them? Mysterious complexity. Often when a system is simple enough that people can understand how it works, people stop caring about it. When we can see something operating mechanically, we trigger the inanimate object viewpoint in our brains rather than the other mind viewpoint. Vivisectionists formally cut open animals without anesthesia because of the technically correct, though ethically misguided, belief that animals were just machines. The AI effect is similar. As soon as we understand how to solve a cognitive problem, that problem stops being AI. As Larry Tesler said, intelligence is whatever machines haven't done yet. Inversely, when a system is large, complicated, and arcane, it can feel to us like magic. Suddenly, we can dismiss our prejudices against understandable processes and instead be awed by the mystery of the unknown. The fact that our brains are so big and messy is perhaps the main reason we attribute mysterious consciousness to our fellow humans. Because we haven't understood the mechanical steps involved, we can retain the magic consciousness feeling. Many video games are bulky and massively complex as well. Here are some estimates from two articles. The game Quake 2 had 136,000 lines of code, Dyad 193,000, Quake 3, 229,000, Doom 3, 601,000, and Rome 2, 3 million. The article on Rome 2 adds that each of the game's soldiers have 6,000 to 7,000 polygons and 45 bones or moving parts. The game's lead designer, James Russell, explained, "Games are arguably the most sophisticated and complex forms of software out there these days." Of course, code in video games has to run everything about the game world, and the amount of code devoted specifically to NPC behavior is a tiny fraction of the total. Still, even just the NPC systems may become messy enough that our intuitions that this can't be sentient give way to more magical ideas about emergence of consciousness. We should bear in mind that codebase size is not equivalent to sophistication, intelligence, or moral importance. Some extremely powerful algorithms are really simple, while some trivial operations can be made complicated by adding a lot of frivolous or inelegant appendages. Appearance versus implementation. The main reason we don't care intrinsically about people being stabbed to death in movies or plays is that these media use deception to fool us. What looks like a sword in a man's chest in a play is actually a sword sticking under his armpit. When actors pretend to cry out in agony, their emotions are not actually distraught to a significant extent. In other words, what looks bad at first glance is not something we actually consider bad when we know all the facts. Video games are somewhat different, because in their case, the NPCs really do get hurt. NPCs really do lose health points, recoil, and die. It's just that the agents are sufficiently simple that we don't consider any single act of hurting them to be extremely serious, because they're missing so much of the texture of what it means for a biological animal to get hurt. There is some degree of acting going on in video games, when characters play out a scripted sequence of movements that would indicate conscious agony in animals, but that is mainly a facade in the video game because the characters don't have the underlying machinery to compute why those actions are being performed. For instance, pain might cause a person to squint his eyes and scream because of specific wiring connecting pain to those movements. In a game, a character can be programmed to squint and scream without anything going on under the hood. The usual correlation between external behavior and internal algorithms is broken in video games, just as in the case of movie acting. The same reasoning suggests that recordings of video games, such as screenshots and gameplay walkthroughs on YouTube, have less significant moral status than playing the game itself, because the characters are all acting without any of the underlying agent behavioral computations going on. That said, insofar as the image rendering of gameplay in a YouTube video still traces the outlines of what has happened in the game, if only in an adumbral way, is there at least an infinitesimal amount of moral significance in the video alone? A more forceful example would help clarify. Is there any degree at all to which it would be wrong to repeatedly play a video of a person enduring a painful death, even if no one was watching it, if only because the pattern of pixels being generated has some extremely vague resemblance to the pattern of activity in that person's body during the experience? I don't know how I feel about this, but either way, I think mere videos of something bad don't rank high on the list of moral priorities. An argument against mere images having moral standing. Suppose we film an actor who feigned a painful death in a movie scene, but was really enjoying the acting experience. The acting is very convincing, and the video itself is indistinguishable from a video of a real painful death. In fact, suppose there exists another video of an actual painful death that is pixel by pixel, frame by frame, identical to the pretend one. Then if we replay the pretend video, are we tracing the outlines of the awful death or the enjoyable fake one? To some extent, this puzzle resembles the underdetermination of the meaning of a computation in general. We always have to decide what interpretation to apply to a set of symbol movements, though typically, unless the computational system is extremely simple, there's only one interpretation that's not hopelessly contorted in its symbol-to-meaning mappings. Maybe an important feature of a morally relevant agent is counterfactual robustness. Hurting an NPC matters because if you hadn't hurt it, it wouldn't have recoiled. And if you had heard it in a different place, it would have recoiled there rather than here. Another possible difference between interactive video games versus fixed videos is that in an NPC, there are computations going on under the hood of the agent, in its mind, telling it how to react. In contrast, video frames are collections of memorized pixel values. If the violent video were not statically recorded, but dynamically computed based on some algorithm, at that point I might indeed start to become concerned. An actor can enjoy the portrayal of being hurt because his brain includes extra machinery that allows him to know how to mimic injury without actually being injured. This machinery is not present in an NPC. Is there any extent to which portions of the actor's body do actually suffer a tiny bit by faking death, and they're just washed out in his brain's overall assessment? I should add that sometimes actors do take on the moods of the characters they're playing to a non-trivial degree. Indeed, this is the premise behind the method acting school of thought. Two examples. One, Angelina Jolie preferred to stay in character in between scenes during many of her early films, and as a result gained a reputation for being difficult to deal with. Two, when shooting The Aviator, Leonardo DiCaprio reawakened his childhood obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD. According to Professor Jeffrey Schwartz, there were times when it was getting not so easy for him to control it. By playing Hughes and giving into his own compulsions, Leo induced a more severe form of OCD in himself. There is strong experimental evidence this kind of switch can happen to actors who concentrate so hard on playing OCD sufferers. Why visual display might matter? A few people do seem to feel moral revulsion about video game violence, and presumably visual display is the reason for this. The images appear disgusting and may trigger our mirror neurons. Without visual display, very few people at present would care about NPCs. But the visual display seems superficial, in the same way that a person's appearance doesn't matter compared with his inner feelings. So is visual display totally irrelevant for serious altruism? One way we might think it matters is that it provides more unity to the characters that would otherwise consist of lots of distributed operations by different parts of the CPU. The display localizes the effects of those operations to a set of pixels on a screen that evolves slowly in time, analogous to biological creatures being a set of atoms that evolves in time according to the brain's algorithms. We might think of the NPC as being those pixels, with its brain computations happening non-locally and then being sent to the pixel body. Of course, this is just one possible conceptualization. The screen could also be seen as playing some roles of consciousness. For instance, the global workspace theory of consciousness proposes that some lower-level processes become broadcast to the rest of the brain in a serial fashion, and this corresponds to consciousness of that information. We could see the screen as playing a broadcasting function, and in fact, the global workspace theory has been described using a theater metaphor, in which consciousness consists in what happens on a stage, while lots of other computing may go on in the background as well. However, unlike in a global workspace model, the screen doesn't have effects back on the brain itself. I think these effects back on the brain are pretty crucial, and indeed, Daniel Dennett considers consciousness to be the effects of famous or powerful brain coalitions on the rest of the system, not just a broadcast of the information that doesn't do anything. We would not say, I'm conscious of X, if the global broadcast about X didn't transmit to our verbal brain centers. The higher order theory postulates that consciousness consists in thoughts about one's mental states. A screen can be seen as a thought about the operations that the CPU is performing, where instead of being written in words, the screen's message is written in pictures. I think both of these interpretations are rather weak and strained, but perhaps they can at least convince us that what the screen does may not be completely irrelevant to a moral evaluation. How important are NPCs? I think video game NPCs matter a tiny amount, even the present-day versions that lack reinforcement learning or other real AI capabilities. They matter more if they're more complex, intelligent, goal-directed, adaptive, responsive to rewards and injuries, and animal-like. However, I don't think current game NPCs compete in moral importance with animals, even insects, which are orders of magnitude more sophisticated in brain complexity and intelligence. Maybe game NPCs would be comparable to plants, which, like the NPCs, mostly engage in scripted responses to environmental conditions. Some NPCs are arguably more intelligent than plants. For example, game AIs may use A-star search, although sometimes plants, fungi, etc. are at least as competent, e.g. slime molds solving shortest path problems. Fortunately, the number of video game NPCs in the world is bounded by some small constant times the number of people in the world, since apart from game testing, NPCs are only computed when people play video games, and a given game contains at most a couple highly intelligent NPCs at once. The NPCs are also run at about the same pace as human players, so it's unlikely game NPCs will be a highly morally significant issue just on the grounds of their present numerosity. a more likely candidate for an algorithm that's significantly ethically problematic based primarily on a numerosity argument would be some silent bulk process run at blazing speeds for instrumental purposes. At the same time, the levels of violence in video games are basically unparalleled, even compared against the spider-eat-insect and fish-eat-zooplankton natural world. NPCs typically come into existence for a few seconds and then are injured to the point of death. It's good that the dumb masses of NPC enemies like Goombas may not be terribly ethically problematic anyway, and the more intelligent boss-level enemies that display sophisticated response behavior and require multiple injuries to be killed are rarer. Due to the inordinate amounts of carnage in video games, game NPCs may be many times more significant than, say, a small plant per second. Perhaps a few highly elaborate NPCs approach the significance of the dumbest insects. On the other hand, it's important not to overstate the degree of suffering of NPCs either. Their decrements to health upon injury and efforts to stay alive aren't significantly different from those of more mundane computational processes found in other software or other complex systems. We may be tempted to give too much weight to video game violence because of its goriness relative to what the algorithms behind the scenes actually warrant. Video games of the future. If video games are not among the world's top problems at the moment, why talk about them? One reason is just that they provide a helpful case study with which to refine our intuitions regarding what characteristics make an agent ethically relevant. But a larger reason is because video games may become highly significant in the far future. As more sophisticated cognitive and affective components are added to NPCs in the coming decades, the moral importance of each NPC will grow. Likewise, the sheer number of video games might multiply by orders of magnitude, especially if humans colonize space and harness the stars for computational power. Eliezer Yudkowsky's fun theory suggests that a valuable galactic future should involve ever-increasing challenges. Others, like Nick Bostrom and Carl Schulman, suggest a spreading of eudaimonic agents, who likewise value many rich, complex experiences. Where would such fun eudaimonic experiences take place? Presumably many would be within virtual reality video game worlds, filled with many NPCs. Actually, in such a case, the distinction between player and non-player characters may break down. These NPCs could include immense numbers of insects, wild animals, and imaginary creatures. In order to make these NPCs lifelike, they might consciously suffer in sophisticated ways when injured. We can hope that future game designers heed this as an ethical concern, but that possibility is far from guaranteed, and it may depend on whether we encourage compassion for wild animals, insects, etc. in the shorter term. Do player characters matter? In this piece, I focused on NPCs because they're more autonomous, numerous, and abused in video games than player characters, PCs. But do PCs also have moral significance? It's natural to assume that PCs are subsumed within the moral weight we place on the player herself. PCs might be significant in the same degree as a spoon, shovel, or other extension of the player's body. Any planning, goal direction, or behavior of the PC would already be morally counted in the brain of the player. Possibly there are ways in which the PC could count a little extra beyond the human player, such as through visual reactions to injury, autonomous responses based on HP level, or automatically orienting to face an enemy. Regardless, the experiences of the human player probably matter more. Comparison with biocentrism. Biocentrism proposes that all living organisms, animals, plants, fungi, etc., deserve ethical consideration because they have, at least implicit, goals and purposes. Paul Taylor suggests that each organism matters because it's a teleological center of life. His The Ethics of Respect for Nature explains, "Every organism, species, population, and community of life has a good of its own which moral agents can intentionally further or damage by their actions. To say that an entity has a good of its own is simply to say that, without reference to any other entity, it can be benefited or harmed." This captures a similar idea as my point that game NPCs have at least implicit goals that can be thwarted when we injure them. While this might seem like a separate criterion from sentience, and Taylor clarifies that the concept of a being's good is not coextensive with sentience or the capacity for feeling pain, I think the distinction between sentient and non-sentient teleology is one of degree. Even fairly trivial systems exhibit a vanishing degree of self-reflection, information broadcasting, and other properties often thought to be part of sentience. Taylor's biocentric theory assumes that life is good for organisms. He says, what is good for an entity is what does it good, in the sense of enhancing or preserving its life and well-being. What is bad for an entity is something that is detrimental to its life and well-being. But if biological organisms have their goals thwarted enough, as is the case for most plants and animals that die shortly after birth in the wild, as well as for survivors enduring frequent hardship, maybe they would be better off not having existed at all. Whether we disvalue conscious suffering or so-called unconscious goal frustration, it seems a real possibility that the disvalue of nature could exceed the value. Hence, even a biocentric theory isn't obviously aligned with ecological preservation. I find it peculiar that this proposal does not seem to have been raised in the environmental ethics literature, to my knowledge. Taylor admits that he is leaving open the question of whether machines, in particular those which are not only goal-directed but also self-regulating, can properly be said to have a good of their own. He confines his discussion to only natural ecosystems and their wild inhabitants. In general, environmental ethics leaves out the machine question, as David Gunkel calls it. Some, like Luciano Floridi, have challenged this focus on the biological. Floridi proposes an ontocentric theory of information ethics that covers both biological and non-biological systems. Does NPC suffering aggregate? Some people have an intuition that small pains like a pinprick don't add up to outweigh big pains like torture. I sympathize with the sentiment, though I'm not sure of my final stance on the matter. There's a counterargument based on continuity, which says that one prick with a 3mm pin is less bad than thousands of pricks with a 2mm pin, and one prick with a 4mm pin is less bad than thousands with a 3mm pin, and so on. Eventually, it seems like one stab with a sword should be less bad than some insanely big number of pinpricks. I'm personally not sure suffering is continuous like this, or whether I would declare some threshold below which suffering doesn't matter. If you did think that pains only add up if they exceed some threshold of intensity, then does NPC suffering not matter because it's so tiny? I personally think NPC suffering should add up even if you have a threshold view. The reason is that I don't picture NPC suffering as being like a dust speck in your eye. Rather, I picture it as being really awful for the NPC. If the NPC were smarter, it would trade away almost anything to avoid being shot or slain with a sword. The reason this quasi-suffering has low moral weight is because the NPC is exceedingly simple and has only the barest traces of consciousness. Even though NPC suffering ends up having small total importance, I still put the numbers in the category of major suffering relative to the organism, so I think these numbers should add in a way that pinpricks may not. Should suffering aggregate at all? Sometimes the objection against aggregation goes further. It's claimed that not only does NPC suffering not aggregate, but no suffering does, not even human suffering. C.S. Lewis expressed this idea in The Problem of Pain, page 116. There's no such thing as a sum of suffering, he said, for no one suffers it. When we have reached the maximum that a single person can suffer, we have no doubt reached something very horrible, but we have reached all the suffering there can ever be in the universe. The addition of a million fellow sufferers adds no more pain. My first response is that our ethical calculations don't have to refer to something out there in the world. To say that two people suffering is twice as bad as one person suffering is just to say that we want to care twice as much in the former case. It's perfectly sensible to conceptualize our computational brains making calculations on the basis of aggregated suffering, or using computers to do so. A deontological prohibition against lying also doesn't refer to anything out there, but is still perfectly coherent as a moral principle. I find it intuitively obvious that ethical concerns should scale linearly in the number of instances of harm, and this is all I need in order to be persuaded. If that's not convincing, I'd make another point. It's claimed by the anti-aggregationists that the suffering of an individual is real, while aggregate suffering is a fictional construct. But this isn't the case. The only real things that exist are fundamental physical primitives, quarks, leptons, bosons, etc., or perhaps more fundamentally, strings and brains. Anything else we may describe is a conceptual construct of these basic components. Molecules are helpful conceptualizations of more fundamental particles behaving in coherent ways together. Likewise with cells, organs, organisms, societies, planets, galaxies, and so on. When we talk about the suffering of an individual, we are referring to an abstraction, the collection of neurons of that person firing in certain patterns that we consider to constitute suffering in some classification scheme. I don't see why we couldn't apply a similar abstraction to describe the collective suffering of many organisms viewed as a coherent group. Maybe one difference is that the neurons in a brain are more integrated and interdependent than people in a society. But in that case, couldn't we at least aggregate the collective suffering of a close-knit human community when they, for example, experience a common loss? Like a collection of neurons, they're all responding to an input stimulus in a way that triggers aversion, and these responses interact to form a whole that can be seen as larger than its parts. To pump this intuition further, we could imagine hooking together the brains of all the community members until even C.S. Lewis admits they form a single individual. Then slowly degrade the connections between community members. At what point do they stop being a single individual? Why can't their verbal and physical contact still count as communication within the collective brain? I discuss more about viewing consciousness at many layers of abstraction in the next section. Individuation versus entitativity. The different components of a video game character may be diffusely distributed. The NPC may have one set of functions controlling behavior, another set computing physics, another set performing graphics rendering, and so on. And perhaps some of these functions refer to shared libraries or DLLs, which are common to many different characters or objects in the game. So is each character really a separate individual, or are they all part of one big program? Questions like these are not unique to video games. Another essay of mine explores similar puzzles in biological contexts. Ultimately, there is just one multiverse, one unified reality, and the way we slice it up when interpreting and describing it is up to us. Of course, some divisions may seem more natural, like separating the United States from Russia at the Bering Strait. Many biological organisms can be separated based on physical localization, although slime molds and even bacteria in our guts provide challenges to an absolutist approach of this type. How do we count moral value if lower systems and higher systems can both be considered conscious? For example, consider a China brain, which is a thought experiment in which each citizen of China implements the actions of a neuron within a brain. In this case, both the individual Chinese citizens and the collective brain that they play out are conscious at the same time. We could further imagine the China brain as being one member of a larger Milky Way brain, and the brains of each Chinese citizen are themselves composed of many subcomponents that we may consider conscious in their own rights. So how do we quantify the total amount of consciousness in such a system? The problem is analogous to quantifying the total amount of leafness in a fractal fern image. Do we just count the lowest layers and let the bigger parts matter more because they have more smaller parts? But this ignores the way in which the big parts themselves form holistic units. A bunch of smaller parts arranged in a more random fashion would be less important. Do we just count the big brain as one more brain, like the smaller brains? But presumably the China brain is more significant, or maybe less significant, than any individual Chinese citizen. I don't have a good proposal for how to proceed here. I do have an intuition that the lower level components account for much of the total value, but this view might change. These questions seem like something out of postmodernism or Hindu metaphysics. Or maybe Spinoza, who said that when we say that the human mind perceives this or that, we are saying nothing but that God has this or that idea. Views like this should be seen as conceptual poetry on our part, not a literal phenomenon that produces weird, unexplained effects in the way that the pseudoscientific Global Consciousness Project claims. Anyway, even though this discussion is rather abstract, it does have ethical significance. The reason our prevailing ethical paradigm for individuation focuses on humans and human-like animals as its central units of value is because it's humans who have the most power and make claims about their consciousness and self-unity, not because humans are somehow ontologically special as a level of organization compared with lower and higher levels. We do also see some higher levels of organization assert their power and self-unity, including nation-states and corporations, though none of these has the machinery to organically generate the stance of claiming that there's something it's like to be itself the way humans do. Susan Blackmore describes the sense of self as an illusion that our brains construct. I think illusion is not the best terminology because a self-model is a real process that represents other processes in a useful way. Indeed, that our brains developed a sense of self suggests that this trait may be helpful for survival. But putting verbal connotations aside, I agree that thinking about yourself as being an entity is part of what consciousness involves in higher level minds and probably contributes to dualistic self versus other distinctions. Blackmore continues, "Everything is one," claim mystics. Realizing non-duality is said to be the aim of Zen. Dropping the illusion of a separate self is the outcome for many meditators. These claims, unlike paranormal ones, do not conflict with science, for the universe is indeed one, and the separate self is indeed an illusion. For more discussion of these kinds of topics, you can see the Wikipedia articles on ego death and egolessness. Case study, SimCity. In SimCity 2013 version, the player acts as the mayor of a city, working to build it and address needs as they arise. The game includes individual people who move around using sidewalks, cars, and buses. The 2013 version is an agent-driven simulation, so the dynamics of how the city evolves are complex and not computable from simple spreadsheet formulas, unlike what was the case in previous versions. That said, any given individual is relatively simple, perhaps not much more complicated than water molecules moving through the capillaries of a tree. However, the city as a whole can be seen as a tiny bit sentient. The city has a welfare level based on the happiness of its citizens, and when the mayor does something good, smiley face icons pop up in response. The city also has evaluation metrics on other dimensions like property value and tax revenue. As agents interact with each other, problems arise, like not enough bus routes, buildings catching fire, too little electric power, congested roads, and so on. The game pops up notifications of these situations so that the player can choose to respond. Sometimes people in the game ask the mayor for permission to do something, such as holding a fireworks show, and the mayor can accept or deny the request. Citizens may hold protests if they become upset. The city behaves kind of like a young baby, growing, developing, carrying on its own functions, but demanding attention from its mother when it needs help, and crying if it suffers. Alternatively, we could see the city like a domesticated plant that grows but needs assistance from its gardener, or else it runs into problems, such as too little water, fungal infection, and so on, and displays ill health by various signs. This example is also a case where the distinction between player and non-player characters becomes fuzzy. The game as a whole can be seen like a sentient NPC, but we could also interpret the joint player-game system as sentient. After all, the game can be viewed as so-called unconsciously computing metrics, and then when something becomes important, the signal is broadcast to the player so that she can give attention to it, select actions in response, learn how to manage better, remember the results of past actions, and so on, a process reminiscent of the LIDA cognitive architecture, which its creator Stan Franklin called functionally conscious in the sense that it implements global workspace theory. On this interpretation of SimCity, SimCity would be like an extension of the player's brain, and could be valued in the same way that we value other brain subcomponents. Sameness and empathy. In summarizing my argument on a discussion of these ideas, I said that humans and NPCs are both physical processes playing out more or less elaborate computational algorithms. I noticed that I was appealing here to an underlying similarity in order to evoke empathy, and this inspired me to write the current section. How broadly we choose to let our moral sympathies extend is up to us. We can adopt a more parochial view that focuses moral weight on very human-like minds, or at least those with very sophisticated cognitive and emotional abilities. Alternatively, we can adopt a more cosmopolitan approach that gives more widely distributed ethical consideration to more kinds of computational processes. How we draw our moral valuation function is not fully determined by scientific facts or logical consistency alone. The empathy we extend to other beings seems to depend a lot on how much we see them as being similar to ourselves. In an interview with the show All in the Mind, James Doty explained, "So the key is how do you expand that in-group to a larger circle, if you will? So that's actually an area of interest. Dave DeSteno, actually at Northeastern in the US, He's actually doing work that shows that if you can take somebody who you don't see as in your in-group, and then look at them and try to sit there and say, is there one thing we have in common? And then you can try to go down the list, and then you'll realize that there are probably multiple things. Each time you do that, it actually decreases the sense of separateness. Vittorio Galisi has written on the idea that empathy arises from neural systems that recognize the sameness of others. His paper, The Roots of Empathy, The Shared Manifold Hypothesis and the Neural Basis of Intersubjectivity, proposes a multidimensional, we-centric shared space that humans use to think about their similarities to non-self members of a social group. The sense of sameness is articulated on many different levels of complexity, and depending on the metric we use, different species might score differently. The Sameness Project aims to channel this feature of our psychology to engender altruism. They say on their website, "For every unique feature that makes you different from the 7 billion other people in this world, there is one feature that makes us the same. We are all people. Humanity is our cause." It's quite simple, really. On the other hand, efforts to identify traits that are uniquely human represent attempts to highlight the differences between us and them. For instance, only humans have complex properties of their language, or Ray Kurzweil said, only Homo sapiens have a knowledge base that itself grows exponentially and is passed down from one generation to another. Or people may identify traits to distinguish only some non-humans from the rest of nature. For example, only mammals have a neocortex, only animals have neurons, only biological creatures have carbon-based organic molecules, DNA, protein manufacturing, and so on. We can think of what Peter Singer called the expanding circle as reflecting a shift from focusing on differences to focusing more and more on similarities with others. If you focus only on differences, then the only thing not different from you right now is, well, you right now. Most organisms at least extend their scope of empathy to include their future selves, perhaps with diminished concern as those selves become more distant. Many species further have kin altruism, and some have reciprocal altruism with non-relatives. Some animals have pure altruism without expectation of reward, perhaps triggered by seeing their sameness with others of their species, or in some cases a similar member of another species. Going further, people often defend the moral importance of lower animals by appealing to their similarities with humans in cognitive ability, intelligence, emotion, neural components, behavior, phylogeny, and so on. As we go down lower, the similarities become weaker, since, for instance, insects do not in fact have the same degree of cognitive sophistication that mammals and birds do. But we can still point to many areas of commonality. When discussing game NPCs, the similarities become fewer, though we can still appeal to the traits discussed in this piece, such as planning and state valuation. And as I observed at the beginning of this section, both humans and NPCs are physical processes playing out goal-directed computational algorithms. We could potentially go further still and consider all of physics within the scope of our concern. We could appeal to the fact that we all share the same multiverse, operate according to the same physical laws, and so on. In the 2013 movie Her, Samantha, the operating system, reflects on how bothered I was about all the ways that you, her physical boyfriend, and I are different. But then I started to think about all the ways that we're the same. Like, we're all made of matter. We're all 13 billion years old. I can see some merit to this view, though my heart tells me not to go for it because I have too many obligations to more animal-like agents that I care about more. In any case, even if we care about the whole multiverse, it's not clear what implications this has for agents that don't reveal either explicit or even implicit values or goals. So maybe the implications would not be very significant, although perhaps one could invent reasonable notions of what's better or worse for inanimate parts of physics, increased entropy, reaching minimum energy states. Anyway, I hope this section helps clarify the debate. I think a lot of the argument over whether and how much NPCs matter reflects differences in emphasis that different people place on different traits. If you focus on very human-like traits, NPCs will be quite different from us. If you focus more on shared traits, NPCs will appear more similar. One might object that our degree of moral concern for an agent is not the same as the agent's degree of sentience. But I think that when our degree of moral concern is based largely on mind-related traits of an agent, The two become basically the same questions, at least if sentience is to have morally laden meaning. If we define sentience by objective criteria, then an agent's degree of sentience becomes a factual question. But most of us think of sentience as the thing that we're trying to get at when we talk about morally meaningful subjective experience. And in that case, tying it with our moral sympathies is the right approach. In any event, even if you don't like this terminology, you're welcome to avoid it. The words we use don't change the substance of what we're talking about. Empathy versus aesthetics. We tend to care about the suffering of others because of feelings of empathy, imagining ourselves suffering in their place. As the beings that we consider become more abstract, it becomes harder to imagine ourselves as them, at least without resorting to unwarranted anthropomorphism regarding what their inner lives are like. In the abstract cases, we need to rely on more general principles and concepts like goal-directed behavior, welfare monitoring, and information broadcasting. These are characteristics that we care about because we can see them in ourselves, and because they seem, at a theoretical level, like the right kinds of things for what sentience should refer to. When we take this stance of looking at the cognitive algorithms themselves and what they're doing, we stray somewhat from the realm of pure empathy, and partly invoke aesthetic intuitions. For instance, it seems more consistent to weigh different systems to varying extents based on degrees to which their various features seem sentience-like. This elegance intuition may encourage us to see trace amounts of sentience even in places, like NPCs potentially, where it would have seemed absurd to see it relative to our gut empathy intuitions. To what extent should our moral intuitions be guided by gut empathy versus abstract aesthetics? I think both parts matter. Unguided aesthetics might lead to a theory that values something like entropy maximization or computational complexity or some other abstract goal without much connection to what we think of as the feelings of others. I find it sad that environmentalism often invokes a person's sense of beauty to justify conservation without much thought to the suffering of the animals that have to live in those habitats. On the other hand, gut empathy can be capricious and arbitrary, and may miss vast sources of suffering that we weren't trained to care about by our culture. Trying to balance both impulses is something I struggle with. How low should we go in assessing sentience? The logic of nature is very similar at many levels. Similar sorts of mathematical principles can describe physics, chemistry, biology, and sociology. Similar game theory applies both to unicellular bacteria and multinational corporations. Fundamental ideas of feedback control, adaptive response, and learning apply to both extremely simple and extraordinarily complex biological systems. All natural and social sciences have an underlying unity to them, because they describe the same reality, where similar patterns emerge both at small and large scales. Humans tend to place themselves at the center of ethical concern, but we are one tiny part of an enormous universe, and over time, we become increasingly aware of how much else may matter beyond ourselves. How much ethical consideration should we extend to very abstract systems, possibly including parts of elementary physics that share commonalities with properties of sentience that we consider relevant? I have mixed intuitions here. On the one hand, I feel like this is just intellectual distraction. What really matters are animals screaming out in pain, and that kind of clear, intense suffering is what we should focus on preventing. Forget the tiny computer algorithms and physical particles. On the other hand, I think like this. What about creatures like insects or zooplankton? Are they in the animals in severe pain category or the intellectual distraction category? I can't tell. And the natural world presents a full continuum of life's complexity, from prokaryotes up to humans. Where along that spectrum do you cut off? If you're not sure, might it be that the cutoff extends pretty far down? And given the enormous numbers at stake, perhaps the lower forms of sentience would dominate. After all, wouldn't altruism be vastly more important in a universe where morally relevant sentience was present everywhere, rather than a universe where it was rare? I don't really know where to end up on this spectrum. For now, I follow a path that includes some focus on both normal suffering by large animals and weird views that contemplate more ubiquitous sentience. What is it like to be an NPC? Let's start with a more familiar question. What is it like to be a dog? A dog's brain has many similarities to our own, though it has some differences as well. Dogs have worse visual and better olfactory perception. Dogs can't speak rich language or do algebra. The ways in which information is perceived and processed by the dog's brain may differ. Fundamentally, a dog is its own kind of entity, operating according to its own modes of functioning. It has some similarities to us, but it's not literally the same. This view parallels Thomas Nagel's point in What Is It Like to Be a Bat, except that I hold the reductionist view that Nagel rejects. But I think we can still talk about what it's like in a poetic sense, with the goal of evoking a certain mental image or attitude in listeners. When we say, there's a unique feeling of what it's like to be a dog, what we're trying to do is suggest, picture yourself in the skin of a dog, but then remember that what the dog sees and feels doesn't quite look as you imagine it. The phrase also aims to highlight the ethical point that we can morally regard the dog in a similar way as we would regard our own experiences, except with some modifications to account for how the dog is different from us. What is it like to be an NPC has a similar meaning, except that here the degree of difference is vastly greater than between humans and dogs. NPCs do not have almost all of the higher level cognitive or emotion processing that we have. They can't compose detailed thoughts about themselves, form complex associations, or respond in sophisticated ways. But they do have rudiments of input-output functions, behavioral reflexes, and possibly planning and adaptive behavior. What it's like to be this agent is very different from what it's like to be a human. An NPC's rudiments of consciousness feel very different from ours, so much that even using the word consciousness or feel can be misleading insofar as it evokes florid imagery that doesn't really apply. What is it like to be an electron? Here the physical process is even more divorced from and simpler than what our higher level algorithms embody. When we try to empathize with something else, we do so by imagination, using parts of our own mind to simulate that mind. But trying to simulate an electron with our brain is like trying to simulate a floating dust speck using an airplane. There's just so much extra irreducible machinery in our brains that we can't accurately reproduce what the world is like to the electron itself. For electrons, we may have to use more abstract valuation. I think the moral weight I give to electrons is basically negligible. The weight I give to NPCs is not quite negligible, though it's still very small. The final section describes the evolution of my views on this topic. I never expected I would begin to care at all about video game characters. If someone proposed the idea to me in the past, I would have written it off as foolish oversentimentality and anthropomorphism. It seemed just obvious that the reflexive rules and simple algorithms used by NPCs didn't feel like anything. In 2009, a friend raised the possibility that relatively uncomplicated agent-like Python scripts might have some moral significance, and I remember thinking to myself, no, that's crazy. I don't care about silly Python scripts. My views at that time were distorted by a confused understanding of consciousness. Even after I explicitly rejected dualism and understood that it was up to us to decide what algorithms we want to call sentient, I retained what we might call the ethical version of Daniel Dennett's Cartesian theater's fallacy, in which I felt like the algorithms that gave rise to morally significant conscious emotion were relatively precise, localized, and binary, in the sense of either being there or not. After all, that's how consciousness feels to us from the inside. But as I learned more neuroscience, I began to see how the brain's algorithms were not binary, but existed along a continuum of complexity, and they could be seen to varying degrees in many computational systems. Still, I thought to myself, the really important parts of subjective experience are things like reward or punishment, reinforcement, and consciousness. The trivial logic updates and planning algorithms of game AIs don't count as part of that. But gradually I began to see that even these kinds of distinctions were not clear-cut. For instance, under the LIDA model of consciousness, inspired by global workspace theory, even extremely simple programming objects can be seen as marginally conscious, insofar as information computed by some routines is bubbled up to be shared with other parts of the program and gets stored in the object's memory, state variables. Likewise, reward signals can come in varying shades of detail, the crudest being raw numerical values. And I realized that I would care about animals even if they didn't learn, but merely used genetically pre-programmed rules to determine their behavior. After all, when humans use cached reflexes and strongly entrenched habits to choose actions, we're doing something similar to game AIs executing fixed stimulus-response behavior. It was becoming clear that a hard separation between sentient animals and simple, unfeeling computational agents could not stand. Fundamentally, these creatures lie on a continuum of traits along various dimensions. By early 2014, the implications of these insights for the case of video games began to sink in. That completes this episode of Science, Ethics, and the Future. Feel free to visit the Foundational Research Institute website, foundational-research.org, and subscribe to this podcast from a link there. Our theme music is Chris Zabriskie's Prelude No. 21, which is provided under a Creative Commons Attribution License and is available on the Free Music Archive website. Catch you next time.